I only hope what I have to say will really keep you interested in physics. What I was asked to do, and I think it's right to say I was asked to do it, rather than me volunteering to do it, was to try and take you through some of the rather strange properties that you get from special relativity and also from general relativity. And of course the man who is behind all this is probably one of the greatest scientists, certainly of this century, probably rivaled only by Newton if we go through physics from when it first started. And I certainly found that his ideas were really quite beautiful. They are in fact very simple as well, because he is a man who believes that there should be some very simple principles from which all theories will follow. And Einstein was rather an interesting guy because, as you probably know, he never fully accepted quantum mechanics. And in fact, I have studied quite a bit in quantum mechanics. I spent quite a long time trying to understand the subject with David Bohm. And I think I know why Einstein was not happy, because quantum mechanics does not come out of very simple general principles. It almost seems like a mishmash. Yes, we know what to do and we get the mathematics going and so on. We get results which are really remarkable experiments. But when someone says, yes, but what does that mean? And, you know, what principles are you building on? So, it might be. Yeah. And you can still see this result now because there are so many different interpretations. And I'm afraid I'm guilty. I have my name on one as a after David Bohm's interpretation, which I was involved in trying to develop with him. So there are many interpretations. Whereas relativity came from one man. And I think because it came from one man, there is a very beautiful coherence in the whole subject. But it's not the end, because we still do not know how to get relativity and quantum mechanics together. In fact, this is particularly so with general relativity and quantum mechanics. I think it would almost be fair to say that there are many people playing with ideas which they think will work, but there's no agreement as to which particular approach we should adopt. Anyway, to get back to stuff that we think we understand, Einstein's theory. What would have been nice for me to say here is that I actually knew Einstein, or I met him. In fact, I never did, because he died when I was still learning the trade. But I can say something else, that I, what was it, danced with a person who danced with a prince in Wales? I actually worked with David Bohm, and David Bohm was a very good friend of Albert Einstein's. And in fact, I thought just to show you the sort of friendship. Here is a letter to David Bohm from Albert Einstein in 1951, where they're discussing, Einstein's discussing his attempts to try and generalize field theory so that he can have quantum mechanics and relativity coming together. And David Bohm is telling him about his ideas of quantum theory and relativistic field theory. And Einstein is very astonished at what David has just wrote. I'm afraid I don't have the letter of what David Bohm wrote to him, because David Bohm never kept any letters at all. He always threw them away. But there you are, that's my claim, that I actually have a letter that was sent to David Bohm and signed by Albert Einstein. That doesn't mean to say I understand relativity, mind you. Okay. So where do we start? I think the place to start is right at the beginning, and sort of ask yourself now, what do we mean by space? And I'm going to ask, what do we mean by time? Now space, what do we mean by space? Well, it's here, yeah. But unfortunately, if you try to capture it, it's really what's between things. And so it's very difficult to get a handle on it. Then come back to time. What do we mean by time? Well, we all have watches nowadays, and we say, oh yes, I know the time. I've got a good idea of how the time's going, of course, whenever you're talking and all the flies. But in fact, what we're looking at is not time. We're looking at something mechanical, and if you've got an analog watch, you actually see something rotating. So we're looking at movement, and we're translating that movement into time. So we don't see time directly, and we don't see space directly. We see space because what we say is we've got a wall, we've got a container, and something we think is empty in here, and we call that space. Now, the sort of feelings that we've grown up with are really the Newtonian feelings. And the Newtonian feelings are something that we live in this container called space, and this container is some kind of absolute. And we also, I think, very deeply have this idea of absolute time. It's sort of imbibed within us. Time is ticking away. It's ticking away faster for me than it is for you on the front there. And somehow it feels, you know, that there's something absolute about it and you can't actually change it. Right, so when we're talking about space and when we're talking about time, we're really talking about movement. Another thing is to say, well, how do we discuss this movement? We have things moving. And if we want to find out how fast they're moving, for example, what we need to do is somehow to find two points. A ball is moving across there. We time when it passes this point. We time when it passes that point. We take the difference. We measure the distance between the two points, and that gives us a speed. Now, in order to do that, you'll notice I've already made an assumption. I've made an assumption that something rigid in which I can make marks. And what we've got to worry about when relativity comes along is there anything that is rigid? At the moment, when we're doing classical physics, we assume that this thing is absolutely rigid. Now then, you'll see me going through this talk, just talking in one dimension space and one dimension time. And if I draw diagrams, time is always going up. That's the convention. Up the graph paper. And x is always moving to the right. And I'll get away from I'll do in one dimension space for as long as possible. And the reason why I'm essentially doing that is because I'm putting in an assumption that the y direction and the z direction are the same as the x direction. In other words, space is isotropic. You probably haven't even thought, could it be any different? Could it be this direction is different from that direction? Well, it could very well be. But the point is, space is actually isotropic. Okay. Now then, when we look out into outer space, of course we don't have any rigid things, so that when we're looking at stars moving, we have to use an entirely different method for finding out how they're moving. And I know we don't quite use this method, but it's very convenient to actually try to set up relativity or set up our concept of space using a radar set and a clock. And what you do is you have got a particle going past a certain point. You don't need anything rigid to find out where it is. You just send a ray of light. And all red lines on my transparencies are always light. That's my convention. So you've got light traveling to this point. It then reflects off that object going past that point. It comes back here. Then from the difference in that time, you say, right, I halve it, and that's the time at which this particle passed that event. That's reading the time on my watch. And I can work out how far it is because I know light travels with the speed c. And then I can do that to the second point and so on, and then I can find how the particle is moving without a rigid frame. So I'm setting up my frame in terms of radar with a clock taking a primary position. Now, what we also assume at this stage is that the laws of physics are independent of what kind of grid system we use. And also we make another assumption. We make an assumption that when I do physics experiments here in London, and somebody does them, let's say, where in Australia, we assume that when they set up their grid, etc., the laws of physics that they get there are exactly the same as the laws of physics that I've got here in support. In other words, and this is now extended to the whole of space, because when we're talking about relativity, we really begin to talk about the cosmos, and we're talking about the whole of space. And so we've got this principle, space is homogeneous, and this implies the cosmological principle, and the cosmological principle says that the laws of physics are the same everywhere in the universe. And that's an assumption. Because it may be, remember when we're looking up at the stars, the light has been travelling for quite some time. We're really looking into the past. And if the laws of physics were different in the past, we'd have a big problem with how to sort things out. We take the simplest principle first, that the laws of physics are the same everywhere in the universe, and then when that doesn't fit, then maybe we can change it. But that's the principle we use. Okay, now then, that's okay when we've got frames fixed in the laboratory. But the next step we've got to ask is, what happens if I actually get on a frame which is moving relatively? Can I distinguish between movement when I'm in a frame which is moving and a frame which is in the laboratory here? Now this was quite a feat for the old guys. We're quite happy with this. We understand this because we have smooth motion, and we know that if we can make the motion very, very smooth indeed, it looks as if, when we're trying to play snooker, for example, if the motion is very smooth, we can play snooker without making any allowances for the fact we're moving. But now experience tells you, when you put a billiard table on top of a double-decker bus and try and play snooker, you know what's going to happen. Balls are going to go all over the place, and it looks almost as if the laws of physics may be different when an object is moving. And it's rather interesting that this idea of the laws of physics being the same in all inertial frames, these constant velocity frames are called inertial frames, they're inert, they're not jolting about. These inertial frames, this didn't emerge until Galileo came along. Before that, the Aristotle physics was that movement required something different, there were different laws of physics when you were moving, because they had coaches and walking, everything was jogging. They didn't have this experience. There's a rather interesting story with Galileo. The way he did this, so the story goes, and I'm not a historian, so I don't know how true this is, and I'm not going to land the boats. He was worried about this very problem. Are the laws of physics the same in moving frames? And in those days, remember, the only moving frames you had that were, this is for a puffing horse and carriage, it's all gone, was on the sea, on a boat. And so what Galileo did, according to this story, was when he was tied up in port, he would do a long jump and see how far he could jump. And he thought, I know, when I get into some smooth water and we're sailing along with the trade winds, you know, roaring, I don't know whether he ever got down to the roaring 40s, but you know, moving along in trades, he then did the jump again and found he could jump exactly the same distance. And that, we are told, led him to feel, to announce this principle, that the laws of physics are the same in all inertial frames. Now, what that means is that if I do an experiment in the laboratory frame which is at rest, I will get one set of laws of physics. If I do it in the lab 2, which is moving at constant speed, I actually get the same laws of physics. So the laws of physics are the same, provided there is constant velocity and there's no jiggering about. Now then, this is quite important, because what this means is that if you lock me in a room with whatever experiments I want to do, and then you do something outside, you either let me stay at rest or you move me with a constant speed, I will not be able to tell that you are pushing me and moving me, provided I'm moving at a constant speed. Okay, so I can't tell whether I'm moving or whether I'm at rest, but anything I do inside the frame. Okay, now what we find is that the Newton's equations of motion are invariant under the transformation from the stationary frame to the moving. And one of the laws that we've got that we're very familiar with is the law of relative velocity. And if we've got a train move, now we go to trains, you see why. You transport that. The train was the primary means of transport in Einstein's day. If you're walking, if the train is moving at a velocity v, and you're moving down the corridor in the opposite direction, your velocity relative to the ground is less than it would be if you were standing still. So you've got this concept of relative velocity. Now, Einstein was puzzled by this. As he was growing up, I mean, I'm elaborating this story, he thought to himself, hey, gee, man, I'm going to have to shave one day. It's 16, I think, when he's 17. And in order to shave, I must have the light shining on my face reaching the mirror, otherwise I won't be able to shave. And then he thought, okay, suppose I'm on a train station, then I know I just switch on my light, shines on my face, on the mirror, back again, I can see this. And in that frame, the light is at the velocity c. It's three times whatever it is. Relative to the earth, relative to the station, relative to the ground. What happens now if the train starts moving, and German engineering, they can move at the speed of light, good German engineering, what happens if that train is moving at the speed of light? Well, the relative velocity is going to be zero. So surely, if this law of addition of velocities is right, then Einstein has done an experiment which shows that he is actually moving with a constant speed. So we're in trouble there. Either Galilean principle of relativity is wrong, or else that law of addition of relative of velocity is wrong. As I said earlier, Einstein was a man of principle. And he said, without knowing any experimental results, he said, that formula must be wrong because I believe the principle is the Galilean principle that the laws of physics are independent of whether the frame is moving with a constant velocity or not. And he said, therefore, there must be something wrong with light, and light doesn't behave in the way we'd expect it to behave. And it turned out that when people started doing experiments, they found that the speed of light was independent of the speed of the source, whether it was coming towards you or moving away from you. If moving away from you at the velocity of light, you still measure the light coming from there is the velocity of light. So clearly there's something wrong with this formula up there. You can't add velocities and subtract velocities. And that then was experimentally verified. But now what is the consequence of that? The consequence of that is now that if the velocity of light is always c, it's always this value 3 times 10 to the minus 8, then when I start setting up my grid, my coordinate system, using my radar set and my clock, c is known, delta t is measured, and I therefore deduce what delta x is. In other words, my space now is no longer something which I take as primary. I actually abstract my space from these two measurements. Now, if these two are known, then we see that x is determined in terms of time. So space and time now somehow co-determine each other. They're not two entirely independent things, which is what Newton said. I'm in a container, and then I've got this pole sticking away. Because the velocity of light is always c, there is an intimate connection between space and time. And this is scary when you first come across it, because you say, it can't be. But this is the lesson we've got to try and get hold of. that space and time are now no longer independent of each other. Now we can very quickly, without too much maths, I've been told I mustn't do any mathematics, but I'm sorry, I'm going to do it. If you want me to do general relativity without mathematics, let's now go back again to this problem of movement. And now, instead of having a particle moving between these two points, V1 and V2, let's have a beam of light. Red again, red is always light. Now the distance, now I'm going into three dimensions, the distance between P1 and P2 is delta x squared plus delta y squared plus delta z squared, square root thereof, Pythagoras. And that must be equal to c times dt, because that distance is being determined by this velocity of light and time on my clock. And therefore, when I square it up, what I find is that this will signify that the two points at the end of these events will be a light ray. This thing has to be zero. And if you look up the books, they actually put this thing equal to ds squared, and they put ds squared equal to zero. That's generalizing. As far as we're concerned here, that quantity there is always zero for light. Now, when we transform to another coordinate system, in order to get the speed of light the same, we have to have this thing with primes on it equal to zero. We must always agree on that. Now, what is the transformation that takes you from one to the other when you've got two frames, one moving at the speed relative, v relative to the other, along one direction, the x-axis? Then you find that these transformations actually will keep this invariant. And it's a very simple algebraic exercise for those people who feel they would like to do an algebraic exercise and substitute these transformations in there, and you'll show you'll get that. These transformations are the Lorentz transformations, and they're the way we transform from frames that are moving relative to each other. And this thing is the key to the whole thing, having that. Now, what we actually have when we want to look at a picture of space-time now, you often see this picture where the light cone is always taken as primary. The light cone is just the light rays shot out in all directions. It's called a light cone. And you'll notice when we draw them in physics, they're always drawn at right angles, 45 degrees. Now the reason why this happens is because we always choose the velocity of light to be equal to 1. Why not? I mean, it's only these ancients who made it 3 times 10 to the minus 8, or whatever. 3 times 10 to the 8, whatever. This is why I have difficulty remembering it, because in my world, C is 1. And then I measure everything in centimetres. So I'll meet you at Waterloo at 7 centimetres. But that's why that's a 45. Otherwise, the angle comes right down here and you can't see anything sensible. So we always draw them at right angles. Now then, the test. If I'm now trying to shave on a moving frame, on a moving train, can I? Will these transformations allow me to? And you can do a very simple calculation, again, it's all algebra, of substituting. Here's the speed on the moving object, here's the speed you measure in the stationary frame, and you just use those transformations, put them in there, and you get this result. Okay, now, if ux is equal to c, that is the velocity of light is c, you put it in there, ux prime is equal to ux is equal to c. So these transformations, I mean, all this is doing is confirming what I've put into it anyway, that the speed of light is always a constant, independent of whether the source is moving or not. So Einstein can shave on the train. Now, what I want to do now is just get some of the consequences of these transformations to show you how space now becomes rather quick. And in order to do this, remember we're talking about coordinate grids. When you're doing a rotation in your coordinate grid, you just rotate them solidly. But the Lorentz transformation takes this grid and squeezes time and space together. But it squeezes it together such that this line, the light ray, always remains the same. Now then, keeping that in mind, let's see what happens when we have a clock which is moving away from us. The picture I have here is we've got this frame S prime, this guy in the rocket S prime, moving away from us. And he's got a clock there which is sending out flashes every second. And we want to look at what is the time between those flashes when I'm sitting here nice and comfortably in my room. Will I still measure them as being 1 second apart or not? Well, how do we find out? Well, here's flash one at A, and here's flash two at B. Now, that is the time axis of S prime, the moving frame, and the time axis always goes through x equals zero. Okay, so that's just, that's the clock, that's a picture of the clock sitting there in S prime. Okay, how do we get this out from the Lorentz transformation? Well, we just put down the coordinates here are always 0, 0, so that first line is rather boring. And then we try to see what are the coordinates of event B using our radar and clock, as I described before, X prime, T prime, and that's T prime. Now, we use the Lorentz transformation to see if we can relate T to T prime. And what we find is that T is not equal to T prime anymore. There is always a gamma, that square root, 1 over the square root is 1 minus T squared, T squared. Now I've just called these time intervals because I started with 0, so T is the same as delta T with that coordinate system. So this is the time interval that I measure for these flashes in the laboratory. And this is the time interval I measure for the guy who's moving. And if you put some very simple numbers in, when he's moving at 0.9 the speed of light, there, you see that he's giving out signals at 1 second, and when we measure them here as we're looking at him, there's almost 2 seconds between them. So we say, oh, come on, lady boy, you've got your clock wrong, adjust it, it's not giving out seconds. And what does he say? He says, hey, I've just done a measurement on your clock. And your clock's going slow. And so we've got this difficulty that when I'm on the laboratory frame, this guy's moving away from me, this clock is going slow. And he says just the opposite, that when you sit on the moving frame and look at your clock in the laboratory, it's going slowly. So there's some kind of relativity. You can't have an argument and say who's right and who's wrong, because they're both right. Of course, you might say, well, there must be something wrong with this. But in fact, we can actually test it. And there is a muon, which are particles which come in on cosmic rays, and they decay with a characteristic time. So that's like having a tick on a clock. Once they decay, that's the tick. You then measure them in the laboratory when they're stationary, and then you measure the half-lives when they're coming in on cosmic ray, and they're moving at about 0.99 the speed of light. And what you find there is that this formula is correct. There's no doubt about it. This formula is correct. Okay, well, you say, well, it's just appearances, and it's because of some funny property due to light. There's one other thing that I'd like to just draw your attention to, another quirky property that comes out of relativity, which goes back to what I was saying about rigid frames. You find that if this guy takes a meter ruler away with him in his rocket ship, and then you measure that meter rule from your laboratory here, you find it isn't a meter rule anymore. its trunk. Again, that comes straight out of the Lorentz transformation. You put in the event, here are the events, here's A, and it's now on the time zero axis of S prime, so it's lying along that x prime axis there. And you have flashes at the beginning and flashes at the end. So you get these coordinates for those events. And then you use the Lorentz transformation. And now when you measure length of something, you measure the length at the same time. You measure the x1 there and the x2 there at the same time. So we put t1 equal to t2, subtract those two, and look, we find that the rest length, which is the L prime, is actually different from the moving length. And then when you put the numbers in, you find, in fact, that the length of the, I've got a centimetre rule here, is only 0.46. If it's moving, relative velocity is 0.96. So the lengths contract. And this is this great story, the great George Gamow wrote the book Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland. How many people have actually seen that book now? And here is Mr. Tompkins on his bike. Mr. Tompkins is a very fascinating guy, actually. He's a bank clerk. But he feels somehow banking doesn't actually stimulate his intellect. So he goes along to people who are giving lectures on relativity and doesn't quite avoid falling asleep halfway through them. But he picks up dog ends here and there. And so he then says, all right, I'm dreaming. What happens if I live in a universe in which the speed of light is only 10 kilometers per second? 10 kilometers per hour, that's what you get. 10 kilometers per hour. Then when I get on my bike and start pedaling, I'm going to see relativity all around me. And as I approach 10 kilometers per hour, I suddenly see all the streets contracting, policemen's contracting, women contracting, dogs contracting. But notice he stays exactly the same. But of course, he's a little bit foolish, because he should have set his alarm and gone up at the right time to get to the bank on time. Because as he tries to go faster and faster, he finds that as he gets closer to 10 kilometers an hour, he's putting all this effort into it and he's not going any faster at all. Even though everything's contracted, the speed is exactly the same. It takes a lot of energy to actually start accelerating to decent speeds to make up the time that you stayed in bed. Okay. Now then, the question we've got to ask ourselves is this merely an appearance, this time dilation, or this length contraction? Or is it something natural? Moment looks like appearance because if you're in the moving rocket, you see exactly the same as the guy sees in the stationary rocket. One of the problems with trying to turn this appearance into actuality is that you never come back together again to compare things. And there is a situation where you can come back together again. And this is the basis of the so-called twin paradox. You have one observer in the laboratory, the stay-at-home observer, that's S, and you have another guy, S prime, who goes swanning off in a rocket ship, decides he's had enough, turns around and comes back again. And then he comes back and meets you at this particular point here. Now we've got it. Now we're bringing our clocks back and we can look at them without any light signals, significant light signals transmitting between the two. And it's quite obvious that the clocks are going to agree. Wrong. The clocks do not agree. So this time change, this time dilation, is not an appearance, it's an actuality. And this is one of the strange features of relativity, is that time is not what we think it is. But we can have different paths, come back again and compare watches, and we cannot agree on time. Now, how do we get that going? Very simply, actually. The trouble is, you see, you say you've got acceleration here, and all I've been talking about are inertial frames moving with constant velocity relative to each other. And as soon as you come to acceleration, you say, oh my God, I think acceleration is something huge. It's a bit too difficult. But you can actually get the whole thing out of special relativity with inertial frames, provided you let this guy be two observers. So this is not really the twin paradox when you do it this way, it's the triplet paradox. Okay? Now the way you do it is you just say you synchronize watches here, this S prime goes away, crosses the path of S2 prime, it's like a sort of a relay, this thing. You synchronize watches and he tells you how much time on his clock has gone. Then he comes back again, you compare watches, he adds his time difference to this time difference and compares it with S, the same time. And that's the way you get it. It agrees, if you do the proper general relativity thing, you get exactly the same result. So I'm not cheating you here. I'm just making life very much simpler. And the reason why this happens is because of the time dilation. And when you add up the time dilations, you find that S measures T, whereas S1 prime plus S2 prime measures T over gamma, where this gamma is this 1 over the square root. And therefore, since gamma is greater than 1, the moving twin has not aged as much as the stay at home. So if you're a lazy devil and don't like moving around, you're not going to live so long as somebody who likes darting around the place. Mind you, whether your heart will actually stand up to darting all over the place all your life is another matter. But the point is that if you stay at home, then you get older much more quickly than if you go out and do things. Now you're going to say, you know, come on, you go, you've got to be kidding. This, when you do experiments on this, you're going to find that you've got it wrong. How can this be? Okay, well, the experiments have been done. And the experiment is one of the good uses of the Cold War. Let's use the 52. This was done in the 60s and 70s, I think. And remember, if you remember back that far, how we were sort of worried about the big red bear coming over with his bombers, so we put our bombers up in the air with new fuel, and so on and so forth. Well, these physicists thought, look, this is a waste of time just doing this. Why don't we try and test the twin paradox by hitching a lift in a 52 bomber? Oh, why not? Now, what is the principle they were trying to test? They were saying that let's fly in this aeroplane, it's moving at a speed v relative to the Earth. But now you can go in two ways around the Earth, as you probably realise. Fly on the equator to make life easier, so that when you're flying eastward, you have the Earth moving along with you, so that your velocity is the velocity of the Earth plus the velocity of the bomber relative to the Earth. Whereas on the westbound flight, your speed is actually slower. So what this means then is that the time rate, the ticking rate, which I denote by tau here, on the eastward bound trip is less than on the westward bound trip. Now, I wish it was as simple as that. Unfortunately, there is also something else, namely a gravitational redshift, because you're flying above the Earth. There's a gravitational redshift, which I'll quantum or some of the other conversation that in a minute. That's general relativity gives us that. And if we take this redshift into account, we then find that it turns out to be the other way around. And then we look at, so the time between ticks should be greater on the westbound. Let's have a look at the experiments. They put cesium clocks in this B-52 bomber and then did the measurements. And you can see the eastward bands have all got negative signs and small. The negative sign is just because of the subtraction from the gravitational redshift. And the westward band are 270 odd. And in fact, when you do the calculations, the predicted values actually agree with the experimental values to within the experimental errors. So this aging of this twin who stays behind is in fact correct. And we actually can test for it in special relativity. Okay, well, so far I have been talking simply about frames which are moving at constant speed relative to each other. But that's a pretty small section of frames. What about acceleration? Surely acceleration is something which is absolute. There's Newton's bucket experiment. Put water in a bucket. Rotate the bucket. And what you find is that the meniscus climbs up the side. By looking at the change in the meniscus, you can tell the bucket is accelerating. Now there's also Foucault's pendulum. Foucault's pendulum. Does he still run in the science museum? Yep. Okay, you set that along a line in the morning, and you come back in the evening, and you find it's actually not oscillating along the line anymore. And the reason for that is that the Earth has rotated underneath it. So there again, you seem to have picked up, by doing a local experiment, you can say, yeah, we're accelerating. So isn't this kind of point? Relativity back on the back burner again, and so that when we come to acceleration, there is an absolute space. This puzzled Einstein. He was really worried for a few days on this one. And he was reading some philosophy, which of course physicists must never read. And it was Mach. And Mach tried to suggest that, see, that there are two different kinds of masses in the world, which I don't know whether people, I didn't realise that I was a school kid, there were two different kinds of masses. I was thought they were the same, and he told me they were different. There is the inertial mass, and that's the resistance that's trying to make something move. And then there's the mass that you use in the gravitational force, gm1m2/r², the inverse square root. Now those two masses, the inertial mass and the gravitational mass, are logically distinct because one is resisting movement and the other one's like a charge which is giving rise to a force. And Edwards had done an experiment to show that numerically the inertial mass was exactly the same value as the gravitational mass. Now Einstein was a pretty sharp critic. And he thought about why can this be? But they shouldn't be the same. Logically. But in fact physically they are the same. And he thought, well, maybe there's some deep connection between gravity and gravitational forces and the ability of particles to move. And it was Mach who said, maybe the inertial mass is determined by the mean distribution of stars in the universe. The sort of totally crazy philosophical experiment that he would suggest is, if you took half those stars away, the mass of the particle would be half. The inertial mass of the particle. And Einstein said, yeah, well, I don't believe that. But maybe there is an identity between inertia and gravity. And what he came up with is a sort of generalization of Galileo's principle of relativity for inertial things. And this one is called Einstein's principle of equivalence. And what it says is that it is not possible by any local physical process, remember I was talking inertial frames about just doing an experiment inside the frame without looking outside. There's no way to distinguish between an accelerating frame, K prime, that's his notation by the way, and an inertial frame at rest in a uniform gravitational field. I'm using here linear and uniform to make life easy. That is sometimes just replaced by a simple local, but that's a technical point. Let's think about it uniform. So, what does this mean? This means that if we've got a laboratory, oh, where's my laboratory going? It's on the other page. Have some examples of what he means by this. These boxes are always my laboratory. If I have a laboratory which has no gravity and no acceleration, then that's an inertial frame. And the laws of physics inside that frame are going to be exactly the same as the laws of physics if you do your experiments in a lift which has lost its contact and is falling freely until you get the bottom. Okay, but you cannot tell the difference between whether you're an inertial frame or whether you're actually falling in gravitation, uniform gravitation. And another example of that is that if you, I don't know why I've got this like a sort of a hangman's game, I must have been playing in some very strange, something, psychologists will probably come up with a reason why I drew it like that. You've got, I mean I could have just rested. Surface of the Earth. But there's a gravitational field. Now then, the physics that you do in there will be identical to the physics if you have a laboratory with no gravitational field and you're just accelerating it with an acceleration A. So the acceleration A is the same as the acceleration of gravity. So you cannot distinguish between gravity and inertia. And this was the trick that Einstein saw that actually then unified his special relativity or generalized his special relativity into general relativity. So the difficulty of the acceleration was it's because there is an identity between inertia and gravity. And therefore he comes up with a theory of gravitation which is different from the Newtonian theory. Okay, and this is now, we're now into general relativity, isn't it easy? Well, I haven't got the mass here yet, but I mean, apart from the mass, the principle is very, very easy indeed. All frames are equivalent. So it doesn't matter what coordinate frame you use, the distinguish between these two frames that I've defined here. The question you then might ask yourself is, does that mean to say I can never tell whether there's a gravitational field present or not? And remember, the idea was that we had uniform fields and uniform acceleration. The gravitational field in the presence of a spherical object is not uniform. That's why I have a local in that other definition. It's only, you've got to get to a small enough region where the thing looks uniform. But if you're in a big laboratory with an inhomogeneous field, then you find that if you drop two particles from P1 and P2, they don't travel parallel to each other, but they actually come together. And this coming together is a signature that you have a gravitational field. And in fact, anybody who's actually known about tidal forces, this is what happens, that when you're in that kind of situation, not only is your object pulled that way, but it's also squashed that way. And these are the tidal forces, and that's the way you actually measure the gravitational field. And in fact, Robert Forward actually had a device to measure the field, something like that, with springs on it and oscillating, and you can actually measure the intensity of the gravitational field in that way. Okay. Now then, what are the consequences of this principle of equivalence? What does it tell us about our space and time now? Well, what it tells us is that there is such a thing as a gravitational redshift. What I mean by that is that if you've got an atom in a very intense gravitational field, the frequency that you see is different from the frequency you would see in the laboratory. And it's redshift. Now, how do you get that? Well, it's very easy, actually. We use the principle of equivalence. Let's take an accelerating frame, moving, accelerating towards the light source. Now, when something is moving towards a sound source or a light source, there is the thing called the Doppler effect. Vertical trains anymore. You used to hear of the trains. You know, as it went past you, there would be a different pitch in the whistle. Okay? It's a Doppler shifted blue. Now then, the principle of equivalence says that if you replace this by an inertial frame in a gravitational field with G equal to A, you will see exactly the same. So in other words, when light is falling into a gravitational field, it must be blue shifted. Conversely, climbing out, it must be red shifted. And there you are, it's the first result of general relativity without any mathematics at all. Of course, it doesn't tell you by how much it shifted, that's when you've got to do the hard work. But it's quite clear that it has to be shifted if Einstein's principle of equivalence is correct. One other thing, light bends, I hope you don't mind my English, bends in the gravitational field. But what do I mean by that? In this case, it's y in this direction and not time, x in that direction. If I've got an inertial frame with no acceleration, the ray of light's not red. The ray of light coming in is not, it moves in a straight line. Now let's look at that ray of light in an accelerating frame. Well, it looks as if the ray of light is bent in an accelerating frame. Frame is moving, therefore, if you now replace that accelerating frame by an inertial frame in a gravitational field, you cannot distinguish between these two, and therefore light must be bent in gravitational field. Lesson number two from general relativity. Doesn't say how much, but this was the classic. This was the thing that got Einstein on all the newspapers. He predicted that light would be bent, and then, like all good physicists, what you do is you go and find a nice exotic place on the Earth to do an experiment. And so Eddington and a few other guys got a ship and went to the South Sea Islands. Now, why did they go to the South Sea Islands? Because there was an eclipse of the sun. And what you want to do is you want to see whether a gravitational field will bend light or not. And what you can do is if you can blot out the sun and have two stars behind the sun,
there's some good, you know what these two stars, you know exactly an angle between the two stars without any sun in between. You let the sun come in between and you see why they went to the south of the island, because that was the only place you could actually see this particular effect. At least I think it was. I don't think it went for other reasons. You've got the moon, you've got the moon in the way of the sun, so you can then look at the stars and you measure where they are, and it appears as if they got close together. And the reason for that is that the light is actually bent around the periphery of the sun. There's an intense gravitational field near the surface of the sun, and therefore the light is bent. And in fact, that means that we really live in a curved space-time. I've made a jump there. Why am I saying this? Well, in fact, we make light define what we mean by a straight line. When we look down at the room, we say, oh, that's bent. Because we're using light to define what we mean by a straight line. Now then, what it appears is that when you're in a gravitational field, the light isn't a straight line, but then, you, by definition, you say light must be a straight line. So something a little bit funny. But then the ancient mariners were well aware. Ancient mariners would have no difficulty with general relativity. You believe that? Why? Because suppose you take a Mercator's projection, a flat map, and you draw a straight line between New York Kennedy and London Heathrow. And then you look at that on a globe and draw the shortest distance between two points on a globe, and you find this straight line is a lot longer than that straight line, i.e. the geodesic on the surface of the sphere. The great circle. Remember, everybody who navigates on a great circle. That's the geodesic, that's the shortest distance between two points. But when you project it into a flat space, it becomes bent. And that bending is, it's like saying, there must be a gravitational force pulling that. But you know, on the surface of the Earth, there's no gravitational force pulling you in those directions. It's just because of the geometry. So everything moves in a straight line, but the trouble is it's moving in a geometry which is warped. So our space-time is not flat Euclidean space-time anymore. And you can actually tell what sort of geometry you're in. Let's go back to the surface of a sphere again. Now, I don't know what sort of mass you sixth formers learn now, but Euclidean geometry in my day said the internal angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. But if you draw a triangle on the surface of a sphere, you can make up the ladder to anything you damn well want. If I draw one here, these are the lines of longitude. Remember, these look like curves, but they're the straight lines, they're the geodesics. We cut the diameter of the equator at 90 degrees here, 90 degrees here. We've already got our 180 degrees, and we've still got that one to put in. There are also spaces where the sum of the internal angles of a triangle is zero. You don't believe that. A rotating disk will give it zero. And this again is taken, I think, from Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland. The point is that if you put little rigid rods around the outside and little rigid rods across the diameter, and you measure the circumference to the diameter in that rotating disk, you find that the relationship is not pi anymore. And that's because the rods have shrunk along here and they haven't shrunk along there. And here's one of these geodesic triangles. That doesn't add up to zero, but in fact you can construct one which is the diameter, and then these become tangential here, here, and here, and the total, not the internal angles, add up to zero. And you can actually tell that, and we can do experiments in our Earth, on our surface, in space-time, and we can actually tell. But we're living in a curved space-time. Now, I want to talk to you for 10 minutes, is that all right? I'm not boring anybody, yeah? The door there, if you could. Okay, so we're living in a space which is a little bit mind-blowing, in the sense that somehow the real problem is, you see, it's very easy to see what's going on in a sphere, because in a sphere that's a two-dimensional surface and you're looking at it in a three-dimensional space. The trouble is we've got three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, so we've got to try and somehow get into a five-dimensional space in order to see the curvature in four space. And that's a bit tricky. But I don't know anybody who can actually think in a five-dimensional space. So if you're having difficulty, join me back. I did hear once that Roger Penrose, a friend of mine, said that I don't know whether he was dreaming this or whether he actually did it, and said that he actually got the perception of a four-dimensional, of living in a four-dimensional space. He's a good geometer and he visualises things very nicely. So whenever we're talking about curved spaces, we've always got to project some of the degrees of freedom out and try and represent them in, say, some sort of two surface, so we see what's going on in that two surface. And one of the ways that we envisage the geometry around the star is through that famous diagram. Here is the matter of this. It's like having an elastic.